got to worry that, all the medications have what's called a lethal dose 50, which is the amount that you have to take for 50% of your experimental individuals to die. And fentanyl has a lower LD50, so it's easy to kill people with fentanyl, unfortunately.
Hey, doctor, after I had my spinal fusion, send me home from the hospital after I was on fentanyl for 3 weeks, a 100 milligram patch and a 75 milligram patch, and she wrote, the discharge doctor wrote, a 175 milligram patch. Well, there's no such thing. And that was on a Friday afternoon, and the pharmacy couldn't get her on the phone, so I went into full fentanyl withdrawal.
Well, I'm terribly sorry to hear that. I mean, unfortunately, bureaucracies have done all kinds of interesting things to the medical practice. There used to be a time that I could take a triplicate form, write down a prescription, sign it, give it to a pharmacy, and they'd say, yes, sir. Now I have to go through some computer program. I have to electronically prescribe these things in New York State because they pretty much accept a written prescription. So, what can I tell you? This is bureaucracy in action. I'm sorry to hear that you had a problem that way.
I ended up in the emergency room of my local hospital here in Riverhead. All right, that's enough questions out of me. WTBC.
And to you, Calvary has a terrible hum. Then I have something to say.
I think W2BZ knows that he has a terrible hum. You've mentioned it, and I'm sure he heard you, but in case he didn't hear you, Rich, W2BZ, you have a really, really bad hum. What do you?
Yes, sir, I think it's coming from my astronaut power supply.
Okay, at one point when we were experimenting with my dropout, I went to pure battery power. It's nice to have a battery available when you need one.
Unfortunately, I don't, because my charger is no longer working, so I can't do that. But this is the first time I hear of a hum, and it's the first time I've used my big Astron power supply, so I would think that's it. All right, W2BZ, please continue, Dr. Lloyd.
Okay, any other comments on this subject before I move on to the next one, which is non-medical?
One last question, Roy.
Yes, Rich.
Okay. About a year ago, I needed intravenous antibiotics. Put me in a nursing home. Get them. For about a month. I had strong words the doctor there that I did not like. When I left, he had a, going to an artery up to the heart. You know what I'm talking about. When he took it out, he bribed a very high dose, 760 milligrams of, I take it now, 100 every night to sleep. Also prescribed a very strong dose of, a high dose of Napacin and a high dose of I wrote that. I thought it was enough to kill a horse. A nurse came in who was taking care of me, said I was correct in throwing it away. I just would have went to sleep, never woke up.
Well, what can I tell you? Rich, we all take an oath by Apollo himself to do no harm, and so I don't think he would have meant you any harm. So I don't know what the nurse meant, what she said, what the actual medicines were, why they were chosen and the dosage they were, and I prefer not to get into too specific conversations on the radio because It's neither the place nor the time for such things. But, you know, you should always adjust your medication with the approval of the physician that you feel comfortable with. You shouldn't be your own doctor. You shouldn't be your own lawyer. You shouldn't be your own whatever, electrical engineer, perhaps. So I don't know what to tell you as far as that goes.
Okay, boys. Well, 2 years ago. Doesn't much matter at this point. Then we go on to the next question. Whatever the subject may be. I'm too young.
Okay, we're going to go to the moon. The harvest moon is simple to define as the full moon nearest the September southward equinox, marking the start of astronomical fall in the northern hemisphere and the start of spring in the southern hemisphere. With a synodic lunation period, the time it takes the moon to return to the same phase, i.e. full to full, new to new, etc., of 29.5 days, this means that the harvest moon usually falls in the month of September, though it very occasionally makes it into early October, bumping the October hunter's moon by a month. This last happened in 2017 and will next occur in 2020. On these years, it also makes the September full moon the full corn moon. In 2018, the September equinox fell last night on September 23rd at 1:54 Universal Time or 9:54 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on the evening of Saturday, September 22nd. Of course, this is a mere instance. When the sun crosses the celestial equator from north to south across the celestial sphere. This is always a good time to check out any Stonehenge-esque alignments in your local neighborhood as the sun rises due east on the equinox and sets due west. Many cities and towns, for example, are laid out with streets running across an east to west and a north to south grid. Let me drop for a second. Why is the harvest moon so special? Well, back before artificial illumination, the harvest moon provided a few extra hours of lighting post-sunset and an opportunity to get the crops in before the onset of winter. But there's another factor that makes the harvest moon special for mid-northern latitudes, and that's its relatively shallow path relative to the local horizon from one night to the next. This all means that the moon seems to hang fixed from one night to the next, losing relatively little time between successive moon rises from night to night. There are a few misconceptions about the harvest moon, though, that should be addressed. It isn't the closest or largest full moon of the year. The moon actually just passed apogee, its farthest point from the Earth, on September 20th, just a few days prior to its full moon, putting it on a more distant side of things. Sure, the moon may look a bit larger on the horizon, rising than near the zenith thanks to the Ponzo illusion, but it's actually one Earth radii farther away. Let me drop for a second. And the sky picture is slowly changing. In the current epoch, the equinoctial point for September falls in the constellation of Virgo, while the March vernal, or northward equinoctial, point falls in Pisces. This scene, however, is slowly evolving thanks to a 26,000-year wobble of the axis of the Earth, known appropriately as the precession of the equinoxes. This also shifts the two about 1 degree eastward every 72 years, about the average length of a human lifespan. Stick around until 2597, and the March equinox will pass into the constellation Aquarius. And in 2440 AD, the September point will reach the constellation Leo. Now, I doubt we'll achieve true peace and understanding in the age of Aquarius, although it's amusing to note that while astrologers do embrace precession on this one point, they largely fail to acknowledge that in modern-day horoscopes, as the houses should have shifted in the intervening 2,000 years since Ptolemy's time. Most Leos, for example, should really be Cancers. Let me drop for a sec. Every lunation of the moon isn't the same either. The moon's orbit is tilted 5.145 degrees relative to the ecliptic. We'd have two eclipses once every 29.5 days, one lunar and one solar, otherwise. The orbit of the moon is also being dragged around the ecliptic once every 18.6 years, mostly due to gravitational pull of the sun, known as the precession of the line of apsides. This orders that the apparent path of the moon goes from shallow relative to the ecliptic plane to ecliptic-like and then to hilly over a two-decade cycle. We're coming off the shallow years of 2015 right now, and we're currently headed towards the hilly years of 2025. So, guys, don't miss tomorrow's Harvest Moon. Let me drop for any questions or comments. I am AC2GS.
About Apollo? Yes.
Are you talking about the moon mission, or are you talking about the god that I took an oath to?
I'm sorry, I didn't make myself clear. Mission.
Okay, what's the question?
Okay, boy, I followed Gemini, Apollo, and Mercury. Very interesting. And I'm so proud that our country, the only country, was able to do it. I remember in school saying that Russia tried to get first, be first. And they actually had a ship that went to the moon, but it crash-landed on the moon. Never heard about that before or after. Do you know anything about that, Roy?
I will ask Paul, but I personally tend to doubt it. The Russians didn't advertise a lot of things that they did ahead of time, just in case things blew up. So it wouldn't be beyond them to attempt to land on the moon, and when things blew up, forget about it. But I think that's too complicated for them to brush under the carpet. So I don't think so. The United States did go to the moon. A lot of people, unfortunately, don't recall that that was not something that the overwhelming majority of the population was thrilled about most of the time. They tended to complain a lot about the budget, a lot about the cost, and I still remember people telling me that the weather changed after they started to shoot rockets in the sky. So we sort of remember it with a little haze and our own special love for the time, but for the rest of the population, it wasn't quite so black and white.
2 ESC, 82 ESC, bring it back, please.
DSC.
82 ESC. I'm trying to call out a cell phone and just get a call ended and texted my wife. She's on a different network than T-Mobile. Get the same thing. I'm a consumer cellular. Can you get out on your cell phone?
I'm not quite sure what this question is about. This is the Limark Technical Net, and this is the Science Talk portion of the Technical Net. It sounds like you have a problem with your cell phone.
Yes, a couple of networks, though. T-Mobile and Consumer Cellular. Can't dial out on the phone to any location. Can you check your phone to see if your cell phone's working? Over.
Okay, once again, I think we're talking across purposes. I am not on a cell phone. I am on a UHF, VHF, or right now it's a VHF radio. It's not a cell phone. Doesn't work like a cell phone. It's basically a frequency modulated device operating a repeater. So I think we got our wires crossed.
2 ESC. I know we're not on cell phones. I am on a handheld. I was wondering, do you have cell phone service? It sounds like it's out in more than one area.
Oh, I am not aware. I usually don't play with my cell phone while I'm on the technical net. If anyone out there has noticed that their cell phone access is off, please feel free to hit the push to talk button.
Getting back to what we were talking about, I don't understand why it was bringing up his cell phone. I remember my father used to say all the time that what we're doing is so quiet. You know, it's not always the time. It's a very made movement.
Okay, and I would agree with your father, but we probably would have been in the minority at that time. The average person, and I distinctly recall the lines about, you know, how can we spend this much money on shooting rockets into the... and there are people starving in this world. And it just went on and on and on. And it was a kind of an either-or zero-sum game to these people. So although your father looked forward, I was a little boy who... excited beyond belief, and I look forward. There's a lot of people which
I got most of that boy. He dropped out. But, you know, I was a little boy. I was born in 1950. We're in the same age group, I think. When I went to bed, my father would lay down next to me until I went to sleep. And I'd always ask him if science, that's the way I've worded it, went to the moon yet. Now, I remember when they launched Sputnik.
Okay, that's very good. There were people who were pro-technology, but there were a lot of people who were anti-technology. I mean, I never really quizzed my father his general opinion. He never really voiced it one way or the other. I kind of learned not to ask scientific questions. When I was about 6 years old, I looked up at the sky and asked, why is the sky blue? And the answer I got, unfortunately, was, why do you ask such stupid questions? So... we all have different experiences, what can I say? But I was just pointing out the fact that although we have this rose-colored image that everyone loved the space program, a lot of them did when we landed on the moon. It's kind of like finding a team an hour and a half before they win the big game. But in retrospect, if you look back on the numbers and such, there were a lot of people who weren't that thrilled for most of it.
Yes, I believe that was a bad commentary on us. Sorry. We've gotten a lot of good use out of space shuttle. I don't know if you know where Velcro came from. With all hooping and links, whatever. You know what Velcro is. The genie designed by NASA. The tethers that held, like Gus Grissom on the spacewalk. He had a little tiny air gun, but if it could get disconnected and roll away in space, instead he had a tether. And that's where they designed Velcro.
See, Richard, you didn't listen to last week's TechNet science talk. I talked about Velcro, and unfortunately, Velcro was invented by a smart guy back in 1949, before NASA ever existed. Velcro was out and about. It was used by NASA, and people got the wrong impression that it was discovered or developed for NASA, but it wasn't. It was a very well-established material long before NASA came into existence.
All right, you're kidding. You're correcting me, boy. That's okay. And anyway, go on and see anybody else. M2EO.
Okay, any comments or questions before I move on to the next space-based subject? Okay, very good. Okay, we brought up the problems that pop up when you place an astronaut that evolved to survive in a one gravitational field into an environment with either a micro or a zero gravitational field for the long haul. This chronically unsolved problem has again made itself to the news. Ever since astronauts began going to space for extended periods of time, it has been known that long-term exposure to zero gravity or microgravity comes with its share of health effects. These include muscle atrophy, loss of bone density, but also extend to other areas of the body, leading to diminished organ function, circulation, and even genetic changes. For this reason, numerous studies have been conducted aboard the International Space Station to determine the extent of these effects and what strategies can be used to mitigate them. According to a new study which recently appeared in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences, a team of NASA and JAXA-funded researchers showed how artificial gravity should be a key component of any future long-term plan in space. Let me drop for a sec. As noted, a considerable amount of research has been conducted to identify and quantify the effects of microgravity has on human bodies. A good example of this is the twin study conducted by NASA's Human Research Program, which researched the effect on the astronaut Scott Kelly's body after he spent a year aboard the International Space Station, using his twin brother, Mark Kelly, as the control. These and other studies have confirmed that exposure to microgravity can not only affect bone density and muscle mass, but also immune function, blood oxygenation, cardiovascular health, and even possibly genomic and cognitive changes. In addition, eyesight is also something that can be affected by time spent in space, which is the result of less circulation and oxygen making it to ocular tissue. Let me drop for a sec. In fact, about 30% of astronauts on short-term space shuttle flights, that's roughly about 2 weeks, and 60% on long-duration missions to the ISS, have reported some impairment to their vision. In response, a co-author of this paper recommends that artificial gravity be incorporated into future missions. The problem is, the longer the astronauts are in space, the more likely they are to experience visual impairment. Some astronauts will recover from visual changes, but some don't. So this is a high priority for NASA and space agencies worldwide. With this application of artificial gravity, researchers found it didn't totally prevent changes to the eye, but they didn't see the worst outcomes. To determine if artificial gravity would lessen these effects, researchers teamed up with the researchers from the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency in a first-ever collaboration. They were joined by members from Linda Loma University, as well as from the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, the Arkansas Children's Research Institute, and the University of Tacuba. Let me drop for a sec. The team then examined changes in the ocular tissue of mice after they spent 35 days aboard the ISS. The test subjects consisted of 12 9-week-old male mice that were flown from the Kennedy Space Center and housed in the Mouse Habitat Cage Unit in the JAXA Kibo Laboratory on the ISS. Over the course of their stay, the mice were divided into two groups. One group lived in ambient microgravity conditions. The other lived in a centrifugal habitat unit that produced 1G of artificial gravity, the equivalent of Earth's gravity. From this, the research team found that the former group suffered damage to blood vessels that are important for the regulation of fluid pressure within the eyes. When we're on Earth, gravity pulls fluid down towards our feet, he said. When you lose gravity, the fluid shifts towards the head. This fluid shift affects the vascular systems throughout the body, and now we know it also affects the blood vessels in the Earth, in the eyes, rather. Let me drop for a sec. In addition, the team noted that protein expression profiles had also changed in the mice's eyes as a result of microgravity. By comparison, the mice that spent their time in the centrifuge did not experience nearly as much damage to their ocular tissues. These results indicate that artificial gravity, likely in the form of rotating sections or centrifuges, will be necessary components for long-duration missions. As concepts go, the use of artificial gravity in space is not something new. In addition to being a well-explored concept in science fiction, space agencies have looked into it as a possible way of establishing a permanent human presence in space. A shining example of this is the Stanford Torres Space Settlement, a principal design that was considered by the 1975 NASA Summer Study. Let me drop for a sec. As a collaborative effort between NASA's Ames Research Center and Stanford University, this 10-week program consisted of professors, technical directors, and students coming together to construct a vision of how people might someday live in a large space colony. The result of this was a concept for a wheel-like space station that would rotate to provide the sensation of either Earth normal or partial gravity. In addition, rotating toruses have been considered for spacecraft to ensure that astronauts on long-duration missions could limit their time in microgravity. A good example of this is the non-atmospheric universal transport intended for lengthy United States exploration, a multi-mission spacecraft concept that was developed in 2011 by engineers Mike Holderman and Edward Henderson of NASA's Technology Applications Assessment Team. Let me drop for a second. As with previous research, this study highlights the importance of maintaining astronaut health during long-term missions in space, as well as long-duration voyages. However, this study is distinguished in that it is the first in a series designed to better understand vision impairment among astronauts. There is no doubt that when it comes to the future of space exploration, there are many challenges lying ahead of us. Not only do we need to develop spacecraft that can combine fuel efficiency and power, we need to reduce the cost of individual launches and come up with ways to mitigate the health risks of long-term missions. Beyond the effects of microgravity, there is also the issue of prolonged exposure to solar and cosmic radiation. And let's not forget that missions to the lunar surface and Mars will have to contend with long-term exposure to low gravity, especially where outposts are concerned. As such, it would not be far-fetched to imagine that the torus and centrifuges could become a regular part of space exploration in the near future. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
The original design of the space station, well, before they gave it the name of the International Space Station, they were going to call it Space Station Freedom. But there was a design that in the front of it, you know, as it goes around the Earth, that would be the front of it, the American side. They planned on putting five modules to get together, one after the other, but in a big circular system, and they planned on attaching it to the front part of the space station, and they were going to spin it. And this was designed, and they were planning on doing it, but then they realized the cost would be phenomenal to try to make the disjoint and the spinning action, and then also would create somewhat of a gyroscopic effect, which the space station would have to counteract as it was going around the Earth. There were too many costs that were involved in it, so they dropped it. And it also would have been the diameter would have been, looked like about maybe 75 feet or so, from one end to the other, so it would have been a little too tight. They would have just used it for maybe sleeping if they could have gotten it done, but that was all dropped because of cost.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be an engineering nightmare, and you would not get anything close to gravity unless you spun it like a top. So I can sort of understand. But, science fiction is cluttered with the designs. Go back to 2001, A Space Odyssey. There's that beautiful image of the space station with the spokes and the rim and such, and that's what's going on there. Kubrick did some very nice film about how they exercised and gravity became different at different levels. And there are a lot of other science fiction shows that have used the centrifugal force and such. So it seems to be the only one that makes any sense that's real. If you go to Star Trek again, going back to Vulcan and such, they just fudged it by saying they have an artificial gravity machine in the basement. So if that really existed, but since it doesn't, the best that I could think of is rotating things.
Yeah, I agree. One of the Gemini missions tried to duplicate that with a cable between the Gina rocket that was launched before the Gemini, and they attached to it, and they wanted to get a certain distance apart from it, and they were going to spin it up, but technically, they couldn't really get that to a point where it would work. And there's also a certain diameter, I forget what diameter it is, that would be comfortable for, let's say, a 5 or 6 foot person standing in this wheel that's spinning. If it's too short, you get an effect that you know the human would notice between their feet and their head. It would be kind of like spinning at one would be like pulling back. So it has to be large enough, and then they're going to get to 1/3 gravity, and then even larger to, you know, half gravity, and to get 1 gravity, 1G, it would have to be a very big diameter. I forget what it is, though. So engineering-wise, yeah, it's doable, but very expensive. Imagine this thing spinning, going all the way to Mars.
But they may very well have to do something like that if they want to get people at the other end who can actually walk around and won't end up being lying flat on their backside for the entire mission. I would assume that what you're discussing is very similar to the forces of gravity and such. And if you get the numbers wrong, you could get kind of artificial spaghettiization that we always talk about black holes producing. So, yeah, you have to worry about the tidal forces or pseudo-tidal forces. You have to worry about the dynamics of the spin. It's an engineering mess. I mean, it's going to require a great deal of very smart engineers to try and figure out how to make that work. I think, unfortunately, it's going to be inevitable because I don't think there's any other way to get around it unless you want to have invalids when they reach wherever they're going.
No, I agree with you. As I've been saying for years, you're going to have that artificial gravity before you go to Mars. But money. It's all about money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost always is about money. And sometimes, unfortunately, there are technological tools which throw all the money in the world at it. You can't kind of jump over the wall. You know, I give you fusion technology as a perfect example. It's not like if you gave some guy in a lab $1 trillion, you're guaranteed to have a working, efficient fusion reactor in 5 years. Sometimes money can't solve things. It's sometimes it can, but sometimes it can't.
Yeah, but a giant wheel spinning, I think, is doable. The tokamak, I don't think I think that's still probably, 20, 30 years away, and they've been saying that 20 and 30 years ago. That's 20 or 30 years away, we're just not getting there. But the giant wheel spinning is a possibility. I mean, they know the gravity's going to be there. It's not like they're going to build this thing and it's not going to appear. They're going to know exactly what the force is going to be, a half G or full G, you know, depending on the spin rate and the diameter. They know that will work. The question is to build this massive thing and then to, of course, get it spinning. Back to you, Ron.
AC2GS. Well, I mean, there's a lot of gotchas, unfortunately. That's not a streamlined. So you're not going to be able to just put some rockets on the bottom of it and get it up into space. So you're pretty much going to have to build it in parts in space, and that's going to be a mess. And is it possible? I don't know of anything that theoretically disallows it. It's not like there are some aspects of science we don't know how centrifuges work. It's just an incredibly big job that one would take, you know, that's almost guaranteed to fail because there's about 3 billion different ways it can fail. So, you know, just take the moon landing and multiply it by a trillion, and you probably have the complications of building a large rotating spacecraft in space.
I agree. It would have to be built in space, Roy, of course. And if you look at the movie 2001, they had it right. I mean, that was not a completed space station as the rocket going up there. It was actually by Pan Am, remember that? Before they thought Pan Am would have ever gone out of business. This was a Pan Am rocket going up to the space station. See that it was partially built and under construction. And they even discussed about, you know, when it landed on the space station, you know, the discussion of the building up and part of the dialogue.
Well, yes, I even remember the picture phone. That was really gangbusters. The future is a picture phone. I remember when I went to the World's Fair in the 60s, they also showed the picture phone. So we have landed finally in the future. Thank you, Apple.
Yeah, but their picture phone in 2001 Space Odyssey, I don't think they were thinking digital. I think that was all analog.
I don't know. I'm sure they had science advisors who kind of thought of that in the back of their head, but it wasn't practical at the time. I think they just wanted a practical experience that spoke of the future. And just like fusion reactors that are efficient 20 to 30 years in the future, picture phones up until this century were always something like 5 to 10 years in the future. It started back in, I think, the 40s, and it was always 5 to 10 years in the future until they finally popped into existence.
Amazing. Okay, continue on, Roy. Very good. WS2N.
Okay. And now for something completely different. When those first fat drops of summer rain fall to the hot, dry ground, have you ever noticed a distinctive odor? Well, some people say that they can smell rain right before a storm. Of course, rain itself has no scent, but moments before a rain event, an earthy smell known as petrichor does permeate the air. People call it musky fresh, generally pleasant. This smell actually comes from the moistening of the ground. Australian scientists first documented the process of petrichor formation in 1964, and scientists from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology further studied the mechanics of this process in 2010s. Petrichor is a combination of fragrant chemical compounds. Some are from oils made by plants. The main contributor to petrichor is actinobacteria. These tiny microorganisms can be found in rural and urban areas as well as in marine environments. They decompose dead or decaying organic matter into simple chemical compounds, which can then become the nutrients for developing plants and other organisms. A byproduct of their activity is an organic compound called geosmin, which contributes to the petrichor scent. Geosmin is a type of alcohol, like rubbing alcohol. Alcohol molecules tend to have a strong scent, but the complex chemical structure of geosmin makes it especially noticeable to people even at extremely low levels. Our noses can detect just a few parts of geosmin per trillion of air molecules. During a prolonged period of dryness, when it has not rained for several days, the decomposition activity rate of the actinobacteria slows down. Just before a rain event, the air becomes more humid and the ground begins to moisten. This process helps to speed up the activity of actinobacteria and more...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oops, got caught by the timeout. Anyway, when raindrops fall on the ground, especially porous surfaces such as loose soil or rough concrete, they will splatter and eject tiny particles called aerosols. The geosmin and other petrichor compounds that may be present on the ground or dissolved within the raindrops are released in aerosol form and carried by the wind to surrounding areas. If the rainfall is heavy enough, the petrichor scent can travel rapidly downwind and alert people that rain is soon on the way. The scent eventually goes away after the storm has passed and the ground begins to dry. This leaves the actinobacteria lying in wait, ready to help us know when it might rain again. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, now on to the next. There was some talk of a possible microwave or ultrasonic Russian spy weapon a few weeks ago. I would suggest that listeners take this next item more as a cautionary tale than as an exciting new finding. A recent research review suggests that white noise, the soothing, fuzzy soundtrack so many of us rely on to sleep or block out distractions, could actually be dangerous. It argues that exposure to the random, unstructured sounds that make up white noise can alter the brain's neural connections that help us perceive sound, leaving us at risk of conditions such as tinnitus and even dementia. But there's reasons to be skeptical of some of the author's claims. The review published last month in JAMA Otolaryngology mainly looks at the academic literature surrounding tinnitus, a maddening medical condition in which sufferers are plagued by phantom noises of ringing or buzzing. Around 10% of American adults have experienced an episode of tinnitus in the past year, according to the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders, while 2 million Americans suffer a chronic debilitating form of it. Let me drop for a sec. Though there is still a lot we don't understand about the condition, chronic tinnitus is thought to happen because of misfiring neurons that are responsible for helping us perceive sound. These auditory neurons get constantly activated when they shouldn't, leading to phantom noises. The overstimulation often happens because the brain tries to compensate for cells elsewhere that have been killed by damaging loud noises or ear infections. Often tinnitus accompanies hearing loss. People with tinnitus and hearing loss are also more likely to develop dementia, suggesting that these impairments can affect the brain more widely. Let me drop for a sec. But the researchers behind the current review point out that not all cases of tinnitus can be traced to loud noises. They cite research in animal and people showing that even long-term exposure to non-traumatic noise below 60 to 70 decibels seems to make people more likely to develop some of the same neural changes seen in tinnitus sufferers, even in the absence of hearing loss. These changes include slowing down our ability to synchronize audio signals we receive from the outside world and to filter out unneeded auditory information like sounds from inside our body, as well as making it harder for us to discern certain sounds such as speech. White noise is a sound that's a mix of all frequencies the human ear can hear, typically sounding like static or an electric fan running. Because it can drown out other nearby sounds, it's commonly recommended as a way to manage, if not directly treat, tinnitus when played at low to moderate decibel levels. Let me drop for a sec. But the authors further argue that white noise's lack of structure can worsen tinnitus symptoms. They even go so far as to claim that, much like tinnitus, white noise could possibly accelerate the aging of the brain. Increasing evidence shows that the brain rewires in a negative manner when it is fed random information, such as white noise, said the lead study, a researcher with the Posit Science Corporation, a California-based company that markets brain training games through its Brain HQ app, in a statement put out by the company. But while it's true there's growing evidence that chronic non-traumatic noise around 80 decibels can impair our hearing over time, even the authors admit that there's only mixed evidence these same noises can affect someone's risk or progression of tinnitus. And there doesn't seem to be any direct evidence, cited by the authors in the review or elsewhere, that white noise itself is linked to worse outcomes for tinnitus sufferers. Let me drop for a sec. Some recent research in mice has even suggested moderate white noise could prevent some of the changes in brain circuitry seen in tinnitus that's triggered by loud noises. And for what it's worth, a 2015 study in Germany found that while noise exposure had no general effect on cognitive function, at least in healthy people. The authors also highlight other emerging treatments for tinnitus, which have shown some promise, such as retraining people's neurons to fire normally again, and sound therapy that relies on structured noises or music. But they also take time to promote their own product, a Brain HQ app, as a potential treatment in the near future. As evidence, they cited a small study published last year that included 40 volunteers with severe bothersome tinnitus. The volunteers were randomized to train with the Brain HQ app or to be a control group that didn't train with anything. Let me drop for a sec. The authors of both that study and the current review noted that slightly more people in the app training group reported improvements in their symptoms than did the control group. But the difference in improvement between the groups was not statistically significant, which is the bare minimum needed to take any finding seriously. And given the small size of the study, even a positive significant finding would need to be taken with a grain of salt. Ultimately, chronic tinnitus is a difficult, complex condition to manage, at least currently, and there are plenty of sufferers who find no real benefit from using white noise to help mask their symptoms. But the authors claim that white noise will actively harm their lives seems way too speculative right now, as is the suggestion that white noise could put a person at a higher risk of dementia. Meanwhile, the rest of the review reads like a subtle advertisement for brain training industry, which has a history of inflating how useful its apps are at improving people's lives. Independent research has found that brain training games do not improve cognitive function, though they do make you more skilled at playing the specific puzzle you're training on. Let me drop for any questions or comments. I am AC2GS. Okay, the point of the last little article is you have to kind of look to see where the source of the information is coming from. If the source is coming from a vested interest, a company that makes a profit off of positive results, then you got to take that stuff with a grain of salt. So there's lots of research out there. Unfortunately, some of them are not very truthful of who's subsidizing and paying for the experiments. But in cases where they're at least truthful enough, you have to take in that bit of information and make your own judgment. So science, you can game science, you can game anything that's created by a human being. So let the buyer beware.
Roy, I wonder if we should, at this time, when there's 1 hour left, to switch over to the space report to give Paul enough time. If Paul runs out of material, we can come back and go back to your list for the additional subjects that you've got on your list. Does that sound reasonable, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW, and the TechNet.
You were mine, Dick. I was just about to remind people once again that the links will be available at roy.ac2gs.com. And any comments, questions, topics should be addressed at mailbag@ac2gs.com. And then I was going to turn it over to Paul for the SpaceNet report for tonight.
Sorry, I jumped the gun. Okay. Darn interesting subjects. I thank you. And maybe we'll get a chance to come back to them. Paul, the September, let's see now, September 20, no. 18. The Tuesday issue of Newsday talked about a man named Yasuku Miyazawa. He's a multi-billionaire man who approached Elon Musk and said he wants to take him and six or eight of his friends on a one-week trip around the moon. And Elon Musk says, yeah, we'll do that in the year 2023 with the new Big Falcon Rocket, the BFR, which has multiple definitions for those three letters. So, if you're willing to pay, somebody will fly. I can tell that they're going to make a simple trip around the moon. I think they're not even going to go into lunar orbit. But that's quite a mission. WS2N, K2RAW, go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N, and I was going to talk about that. But, you know, that's about... Let's see, 2018, they're probably 5 years away, and maybe more. That's the predicted time frame, 2023. And there's going to be many flights before they put him into this new rocket that hasn't even flown yet. BFR is really a Falcon 9 on steroids, bigger engines, some 31 different engines on a first stage, seven engines on the second stage. They're not called Merlin D engines anymore. He's got new names called the Raptor engines. The rocket will not fly on RP-1, which is really kerosene and liquid oxygen. It will fly on liquid methane and liquid oxygen on both stages, the first and second stage. Second stage is really essentially a second stage and a spacecraft all in one.
Did you say 30 engines on the first stage? In which case, what's the total amount of projected thrust of that, Paul? Go ahead.
31 engines, and I think he was, well, he originally wanted 40, don't know, 42 engines or something. Now that I think they're down to 31. So total thrust, what it was going to be, around 12 or 13 million. He originally started up in the 20 million category, you know, but it's working its way down. But yeah, it would be more than the Saturn V. He's got over 100, I would think it's 1,000 square meters. He just up the volume of it to 1,100 square meters, you know, living space inside the this rocket. So this fellow from Japan owns Suzu. Suzu is a company that makes some kind of suit that you would put on with a bunch of dots all over it, and then you would scan yourself and send it to his company, you know, through a computer, and you would wind up with the perfect suit. The guy's made $1 billion, a couple of million dollars, and now he's got the money to do this. About 3 or 4 years ago, Elon Musk made an announcement that there were 2 people willing to pay to fly around the moon, and they planned on going on a Dragon spacecraft. And the Dragon spacecraft was going to be on top of a Falcon Heavy rocket, and that's like 3 Falcon 9 boosters bolted together with a second stage on top of that, and on top of that would be the Dragon spacecraft. And he was going to use that to send these 2 people to and around the moon and then come back. One of those people happened to be this fellow from Japan. I'm not going to pronounce his name, but the good news is in his first name he has USA inside of his first name. Y-U-S-A-K-U. And then his last name is M-A-E-Z-A-W-A. And your pronunciation is probably pretty good there. Yeah, that was the original plan. Well, that's changed. He's going to forget about human rating the Falcon 9 Heavy. He's going to still keep the human rating going for Falcon 9, a regular Falcon 9, which he plans on sending people up next year, you know, to the International Space Station from Launch Complex 39A. Still plans on doing that. He's got another launch complex in Florida, which is called Launch Complex 40, and for now he's been using that launch complex to launch payloads to either low Earth orbit or geosynchronous orbit. You know, all these different companies around the globe. But 39A, he's now dedicated that launch complex to the Falcon 9 rocket, which is to launch people on the Dragon spacecraft. But this guy here and whoever the other guy was canceled that program and put them on a BFR rocket, the big Falcon rocket, to eventually be launched from Launch Complex 39A to and around the moon. He's not being specific about the orbit. He might go out to a near halo orbit, roughly about 40,000 miles out away from the moon, and then come back past the moon and then back to Earth. But yes, he doesn't plan on orbiting the moon at this time with these people. So they would be the first paying. The money that's going to be exchanged was not spoken about. My guess, Launch, an astronaut from Russia right now, they're up to $80 million, so I'm sure it's probably close to that just to get to orbit. Now, this guy's going to go to the moon, I'm dropping. And he's going to take 6 people with him. So if you want to start doing the math, 7 people to go around the moon, and he's willing to pay for the whole tab. He's going to look for a bunch of artists, people that are really good in different forms of art, maybe somebody from music, somebody from, you know, maybe a painter or something. And he's going to get these 6 artists, and he's going to get on a BFR rocket with them and fly to the moon. So that was the story. It was released the other day. He had a webcast on SpaceX webcast, which I saw, And they, you know, they talked about the VFR rocket. They talked about the changes in the rocket itself. And they, then they introduced this fellow. So that's the story on that. If you want any other information about this topic, back to you, Dick.
Yes, I do. The SpaceX Big Falcon rocket is what I think he's calling it right now, VFR. 31 engines. That means each engine is close to 500,000 pounds of thrust, and 31 of them. And you want all 31 to start up at the exact same time, run the exact same amount of thrust, or maybe some of them are throttleable, so you can, and some of them are steerable. Seems to me like back in the Apollo days, we were in competition with the Soviet Union, and they were developing a very large rocket that had a large number of engines, and I think they ran into a significant problem of engine instability. Could all of the multiple engines all give the same amount of thrust at the same time? Do you have a turbo pump on each individual engine, or do you have a common turbo pump with a bunch of fancy piping feeding the fuel and oxidizer to all the engines? And there's a zillion ways that aerodynamic instability, where the a pressure wave from, let me drop this. A pressure wave from one engine can affect an adjacent engine. So 31 individual engines all working perfectly well. From my point of view, that's a very tall order. There's a zillion ways that could give you some grief. And Elon is a very smart guy. I wonder if he's got some really fancy computer modeling programs to solve many of these aerodynamic and fluid dynamic problems. There's only a zillion ways that can give you some grief, as I said before. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, he's pretty good at this. The Falcon 9 has 9 Merlin D engines. He's flown 50 or 60 of these things so far since 2012. And he's only had one engine out on all of those flights. And he builds these things like the Falcon 9. If an engine fails, he'll still make it to orbit and most likely be able to have enough power to get the customer's payload to orbit. So he's okay with that. So those 9 engines, they seem to light at the exact same time. He has the TTEP. TTEP is a fuel that's similar to what Roy was speaking about. It's a hypergolic fuel. That's his ignition system. Falcon 9, so you'll see a green flash right before they take off. You really see very good at night. You'll see a green flash, and then that will ignite the RP-1, the kerosene and liquid hydrogen. Those engines, those 9 engines, are actually going off milliseconds apart from one another. You can't see it. It looks like they're all going off at one time. And then, if something fails before they launch, he's got releases that won't release, and that rocket will still stay there. They'll go to shutdown and then they'll abort. We drop it. On the Falcon 9 Heavy, the one that we saw launch last February, where he launched his Tesla cart out to Mars somewhere, and it was his first test of the Falcon 9 rocket with Falcon Heavy. He calls it the Falcon Heavy now, so we'll call it that. That had 27 engines, so you had, 3 boosters. So what I'm talking about now is only 31 engines, so it's only 4 more engines than the 27 that he had launched in February, which he plans on launching, by the way, at the very end of this year or beginning of next year. Another one he's actually going to be launching for the military, and then soon after that he's going to contract with Saudi Arabia for the satellite to orbit, also use the Falcon Heavy. So those engines, all 27, ignite at a slightly different time. Again, we can't see it. It happens too fast. If you had one of these cameras that you view it in slow-mo, you would see each one light individually. So that's the deal on that. Now, this VFR is I think it's about 120 meters long, the whole thing, you know, from the first stage plus the second stage. Second stage is really a spacecraft as well.
Yeah, Newsday said it's a 387-foot rocket. Go ahead.
Okay, that makes sense. I think the official number I've written down over here was 118 meters, because, you know, it's slightly different than, a little bit longer than the original one. It's got these three fins on the bottom.